This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Gardens' 25th Annual Barrows Conservation Lecture Series begins March 1st. Since 1993, the zoo has invited naturalists and scientists to speak on wildlife issues and global conservation efforts. As a preview of the 2017 series, Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard recently talked with each of this year's speakers. Today's show was recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments this afternoon. We begin with Thane Maynard's conversation with Dr. David Morgan, who directs a research program to monitor great ape activity in the Congo Basin.
Dr. David Morgan, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're excited because you're going to come speak soon on March 1st at the Cincinnati Zoo's Conservation Lecture Series.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, Cincinnati's been involved in the region where I work for a long time, and I'm excited about coming to visit there. This will be my first visit.
Yeah, well, you know, I first have to ask, am I catching you in the Congo or up on Lake Michigan?
No, I'm actually at Washington University in St. Louis.
There you go.
My wife and I work out of the anthropology department here.
You are a busy person because listeners may not know, but you spend the lion's share of your time playing a major role conserving and helping run parks in the Republic of Congo and working with lowland gorillas. But you're also a college professor and also, I think, allied with the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago.
Yeah, that's correct. I kind of wear many hats. I'm fortunate to do that because it suggests that there are a lot of different people, organizations interested in helping out Western lowland gorillas and interested in our project in particular. So we've got really good support, and I'm fortunate to be able to travel amongst these areas and talk to these different people and work out in the field as well. It's something I've wanted to do my whole life.
Well, I'm sure at Lincoln Park, it's much like at Cincinnati Zoo. Our gorillas are our most popular exhibit. People love to see their interaction. They're fascinated with their family structure and behavior. Tell us a bit about both what drew you to gorillas as well as how in the world a guy from kind of a zoo field says, I'm going to go ahead and end up being a field biologist in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I was always drawn to the similarities that you see when you look at gorillas and seeing how they interact, seeing how mothers care for their kids, and the silverbacks help protect their groups in these really complex environments. I was really fascinated by that, as well as the forest itself. I'm interested in ecology. And yeah, that's what drew me to them. And it was a first step working at a zoological park when I was younger and getting to know how they really interacted, and just not by reading in books and or seeing them on TV. So really getting in and being able to observe them and see how they interact with each other and humans as well that were caring for them. You know, I was drawn to that. I wanted to know as much as I possibly could about gorillas. And I was fortunate to come around at a time when zoos started to take an interest in protecting gorillas out in the wild. And that became more of a program for several of these big zoological parks like Cincinnati and Lincoln Park Zoo. And so I was kind of at the forefront of that and really happy to see that kind of interest and involvement in the gains that are being made.
Now, most listeners could probably imagine a little bit about what your life was like when working with the zoo or what your life is like perhaps at a university as a researcher or a professor. But most of us would not have any concept of what your life might be like when you're working in the Congo. Tell a bit about both your work there as well as the status of lowland gorillas in Africa.
Working in the Republic of Congo is fascinating. Every time I go there, it's like this is the first time going there. I always learn something new, whether it's related to the gorillas or their habitats or the people. We're fortunate to have great teams out there, Congolese, who work with us and have been for many years, and they're interested in the work, they're interested in protecting the apes. So it's a really unique atmosphere, I think, in terms of a grade ape research. And we're happy that we've got that out there. And it makes it so worthwhile to see, you know, the people who are ultimately going to end up conserving these species in the long term are that involved. So we work heavily with the local indigenous people, from forest foragers, oftentimes called pygmies, to college graduates from the local universities. And they're at the forefront with us and studying the behavior and the ecology of the apes. But it's hard work. And, you know, we get up at one of the sites at 4 a.m. in the morning to get prepared to be out by 6 a.m. To follow the apes on their daily walks. And we do that till about 5:30 at night. We eat around a campfire. So it's my cricket, my wife, she likes to call it very rustic living. It's living out in tents. We enjoy that, and we try to have as little impact as possible out in these forests on the apes. And it's really, really neat and an exciting life. You not only learn a lot about gorillas, you come across elephants and other wildlife as well, because it's such a special place and still remains intact.
All right, so give us a picture of this. You're camping in a tent. You're there in a rainforest that's home to gorillas, and there's elephants nearby. Surely the elephants must be dangerous, even if the gorillas are not.
Yes, they are. We have to be very cognizant of the presence of elephants around us, not leaving food out to like attract them to the camp. That can be a dangerous situation. And just when we're walking with the gorillas out in the forest, they're attracted to many of the same food items that the elephants are. There's competition between them. And, of course, elephants, they dictate where we kind of move. We try to stay away from them just like the gorillas do. I mean, if we're with a group of gorillas, they'll oftentimes tell us that elephants are coming. They just up and flee immediately. They run. And that's even before the elephant. We even know the elephant's there quite often because they know how dangerous it can be. And we just kind of shatter ourselves around them and get around them just like the gorillas do. So it's really important to be cognizant of those type of situations. Working with the trackers is a main aspect that, you know, they try to ensure this kind of safety and this awareness while we really collect and focus on the animals themselves.
Now, of the years you've been going to the Republic of Congo, have you seen an increased interest of people that either are native Congolese or even live in that region?
There is an increasing interest in the apes, particularly as we start to promote there's possibilities to earn a living studying chimpanzees and gorillas out in these forests using new technologies such as handheld, you know, iPads and things like that, technology that isn't very prevalent in other aspects of Congolese society. So this new technology, these opportunities to make a living full-time, when they had no idea about it, it's never been promoted, like at the local universities. There's really not any courses in terms of conservation or animal research available. Most courses in Congo are focused on, you know, extraction of resources, agriculture, really practical things. But we know, and so the government is becoming aware of the importance of conserving the forests in terms of climate, in terms of water security, and those types of things. So it is becoming more prevalent. And as we have Congolese move up through the ranks and become now directors of parks, important people in some of the research aspects, there's more opportunities for them to see that, and that's having an impact on getting others involved.
So it sounds like, from your description, that perhaps you and your wife largely pay your bills working through American University in St. Louis. But how do you fund all this work in Africa? Because it sounds, by the time you've talked about hiring staff and funding people and technology, and of course, even your travel and running national parks, talk a bit about the partnerships it takes to try to help protect gorillas.
It takes quite a few partnerships to help run these projects and then protecting them in different ways. Funding is, of course, a major aspect. We work with lots of zoological parks in trying to generate money. The U.S., we're fortunate that these zoos are interested in doing that and providing such support, but we also go to academic grants seeking funding for specific projects. We look into the medical field because we know how important and how closely related we are to chimps and gorillas, and there is funds sometimes available for that type of research, like into malaria and issues like that. So we are constantly writing proposals, refining them, seeking out funding opportunities. And, you know, these larger grants sometimes come along from the U.S. government, has been a major supporter of research and conservation in the region where we're working, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so through these types of partnerships, we get to know a lot of people who, you know of funding sources, and we work together with a lot of different researchers who have different expertise. There's no way we could do this on our own, looking at ecology or health. You need expertise from all these different areas, and we're at a time now when people are really collaborating quite well and in informative ways and addressing questions we could never address without such collaboration.
Well, it's an exciting time, but also a challenging time, and we look forward this spring to having you come, and we'll hear more of your adventures and what it takes to save gorillas.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to meeting the gorillas there as well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been gorilla conservationist Dr. David Morgan.
Dr. David Morgan, he'll be the first speaker in the Barrows Conservation Lecture Series on March 1st. Today we're hearing from all of this year's Cincinnati Zoo Barrows Conservation Lecture Series speakers. We'll continue after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today's show was recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. We continue with our preview of this year's Cincinnati Zoo Barrows Conservation Lecture Series with Dr. Derek Lee and Monica Bond, wildlife biologists and co-founder of the Wild Nature Institute, which monitors giraffes in Tanzania. They recently spoke with Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard.
Monica Bond and Derek Lee, thank you for joining us all the way from Tanzania.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Thane. Great to be here.
Well, certainly one of my favorite places in the world is northern Tanzania, so I know the work you do there is important. In fact, the Cincinnati Zoo has been a modest supporter of your group, the Wild Nature Institute, for a couple of years. Tell us a bit about your work in Africa.
Sure. The giraffe is an African icon. It's recognized and loved by people all over the world, but unfortunately, wild giraffes are in trouble. Their savanna habitat is being lost as it's converted into farms and houses, and the trees they need for food are being chopped down for fuel, and they're also being hunted illegally for their meat. And our conservation research is discovering where Maasai giraffes are doing well, where they are not, and why. And we're working to protect and to connect the areas that are most important to Maasai giraffes.
Now, many people are very familiar with, say, Serengeti National Park, you know, one of the most iconic protected areas in the world. In a big park like that, are the giraffes thriving but having a hard time out near townships where people are putting up fences? Or tell us what it feels like.
Well, unfortunately, giraffes are really only doing very well inside protected areas like Serengeti National Park and Tarangire National Park, where we work. There is still a lot of habitat that's good that's still available for giraffes outside the parks, and that's a big part of our work, is to try and figure out how people and giraffes can coexist in that habitat that's remaining.
So tell us a bit about numbers. I know I've read that I guess suddenly we're down below 100,000 giraffe in Africa, and that's down from huge numbers. When I first went to East Africa, northern Tanzania in 1983, I mean, you couldn't drive 1 kilometer without seeing giraffe.
That's right. It's been a precipitous decline. And because giraffes are so huge and obvious on the landscape, it took a while for people to realize that they were declining so bad. If there's any around, you do see them. And back a few decades ago, there was over 150,000 giraffes. And now, like you say, we are below 100,000, almost a 40% decline just in the last few decades. And going back even farther, there was, I'm sure, many more giraffes than there are.
Right. And Tanzania is a real stronghold for giraffes, and it actually supports more than any other country. And they also have designated the Maasai giraffe as their national animal. But like around the world, people here are also not aware of the plight of the giraffe in the wild. So we really feel it's our job as conservation scientists to bring this issue to light and to provide solutions that are based in our science that will be most effective to protecting giraffes.
Of course, the giraffe is an example and a noted one because even a 2-year-old child can point at a book and tell a giraffe, right? But it sounds like it's the same problem facing lots of wildlife, and certainly not just in Africa. The same thing is true right here in North America. But in this case with the giraffe, the combination of human development, subdivision of land, and now you had mentioned, and I didn't realize it's a problem, I think, bush meat, and the fact that people are poaching them, I assume, to eat them.
Yeah, that's right. The bush meat poaching is a big problem. We found in our research that the giraffe population is declining mainly because adults are being killed illegally for their meat. And so we're working with an anti-poaching organization to stop this. It's a big business operation. It's not just small-time people trying to feed themselves. This is a market-hunting operation with distributors. This is a market-hunting operation with distributors and financiers and middlemen. So it's big business, market hunting. It's the biggest problem that we have locally, but also habitat loss is also a big problem.
Yeah. For example, farms and houses are being built as the human population increases in the Tarangire ecosystem and elsewhere in Africa. And then, of course, a lot of people use charcoal for cooking their food. And pretty much everybody in Tanzania cooks their food using charcoal. And so that entails cutting down the acacia trees that giraffes like to eat. So they're losing their food sources and they're losing the habitat, the savanna habitat, and then they're also being killed for meat.
I know that your group, the Wild Nature Institute, is also involved in a Tanzanian program about carbon issues and around protecting forests and trees. Tell a bit about that.
Yeah, we are using our data to inform land use planning in the area around Tarangire National Park. So a lot of these villages, and a village is sort of like a township or a small county, these villages are trying to make land use planning so that they can better manage their own natural resources. And so we are providing them with information that we have about the wildlife and about the natural resources so they can make those plans based on data.
The interesting thing about the Tarangire ecosystem, and you pointed out the Serengeti is very famous, but a lot of people haven't really heard of Tarangire, but it actually supports a very, very, very rich diversity and abundance of large mammals. It's actually second only to the Serengeti in the giraffe density. It has a lot of elephants. It even has its own distinct migration of wildebeest and zebras. But it's mostly unprotected in this ecosystem, which is why we chose to focus our work there.
It is a remarkable place. The baobab trees, the large elephant herds, and as you said, the iconic giraffe. I'm fortunate to have been there a number of times. I'm going back again this July, so I hope I'll see you when I'm there.
That would be wonderful. Karibu sana.
That's right. Well, this is intriguing to me because everybody listening, and probably everybody everywhere, loves giraffes. Because of the recent news through the IUCN Red Book listing of them as threatened, there's more concern about giraffes. So both of those things are real. This question of how do people help and what effectively can protect them from poaching, there's a disconnect there. So tell a bit about either what you all do at Tarangire or what Wild Nature Institute does, or how people living right here in Cincinnati can play a role to help protect wildlife in Africa.
Well, conservation of giraffes is really going to involve not only the local communities here in Tanzania, but also a constituency around the world. And so what we're doing is trying to, what we're doing is a giraffe pride campaign, basically. We're creating giraffe-themed educational materials for Tanzanian school children and also U.S. school children, so we can build a constituency around the world of people who care about giraffes and work to protect them. And these materials are using giraffes to teach science, math, geography, reading, language, a range of subjects, and also facilitating discussions about issues people and wildlife are facing and how people can organize to help themselves and wildlife to thrive. Now, of course, here in Tanzania, one of the things people can do is planting trees, using fuel-efficient stoves so they don't use as much wood for their cooking, so we can protect habitat, not eating bushmeat, of course, and then being ambassadors and conservationists themselves. And what people can do in the U.S. is give financial support. For example, folks out there who are listening, keep going to the Cincinnati Zoo. Have fun seeing the giraffe, feed the giraffe, and know that the money that you give to the zoo for that is then in turn helping wild giraffes to survive through projects like ours.
And Monica, I know you've written a children's book about giraffes. We're going to get that in our zoo shop, so that'll help a little bit. But how's the reception been for your book?
Oh, amazing. We've distributed nearly 6,000 of those books, a Swahili and English version of the book. So it's actually teaching literacy as well as inspiring people to love giraffes. And we're distributing them at schools all around Tarangire National Park, also Ruaha and Serengeti. So these are, of course, parks that have significant populations of giraffes. So we're inspiring people to care. And we're also doing teachers' workshops where we're providing activities and lesson plans for teachers so they can use the book more effectively, ultimately reinforcing pride in Tanzania's wildlife and making it fun for children to learn about the natural world. So thank you for selling that book. And for every time somebody buys a book in your store, it's basically providing a book for a Tanzanian school child here in Tanzania.
That is great. Well, we are excited that you all are coming to speak in our lecture series this spring. We take many folks to northern Tanzania, so you'll have a full house. There's no doubt about that.
Wonderful.
Terrific. We're thrilled.
And thank you so much, Cincinnati Zoo, for supporting our work.
You bet. We're glad to do it. I look forward to seeing you this spring here in Cincinnati, and thanks for taking some time out of your day.
Thank you.
You bet. Glad to do it.
Dr. Derek Lee and Monica Bond will be speaking at the Cincinnati Zoo on March 29th. The third speaker in this year's Barrows Conservation Lecture Series is Dr. Craig Packer, Distinguished McKnight University Professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior at the University of Minnesota. He recently talked with Thane Maynard about efforts to protect and conserve lions in the wild.
Hi, Dr. Craig Packer.
Hello.
This is Thane Maynard, and I appreciate you taking some time to be with us today.
Certainly.
And we're very delighted that you are coming out this spring to speak in the Cincinnati Zoo's conservation series. We have lions, we love our lions, and we want to hear straight from the horse's mouth of what the conditions are in the wild.
Well, the lions are in trouble. They need an awful lot of land. They cause a lot of trouble. And in some areas, it's very difficult to imagine any kind of barrier between lions and people. And so there's still manning lions in Africa. There's a lot of livestock being eaten. And these are the resources of very, very poor people. And so there's no real toleration for livestock losses, and people will kill the lions in retaliation. And of course, any man-eating lion has to be destroyed. So there's a lot of conflict. We have a very rapidly growing human population. And so these conflicts are just intensifying as people move into areas that in the past were buffer zones between the parks and the human-occupied areas. However, there are places where the lions are safely separated from people, and the fences prevent these kinds of conflicts from developing in the first place. And so lions in fenced reserves actually are thriving, and a larger proportion of lions each year are now found inside the fenced reserves. Some of these fenced reserves are quite large, like Kruger National Park in South Africa is about the size of New Jersey, and there are proposals to put fences in a number of areas, and these are possible in areas where the wildlife occupy one side of a boundary and there's agriculture on the other side. And so there are fenced reserves. That's a hopeful note because they work for protecting lions, but not everywhere can be fenced. And so there's a need for conflict mitigation projects to somehow help people improve the husbandry of their livestock so they don't lose their livestock in the first place. And so these are challenges. But even bigger challenge than all of that is the fact that even in the best protected national parks, conservation is very expensive. We estimate that it costs about $2,000 per square kilometer every year to protect lion habitat. That's about the same as it costs to protect some of our own parks here in the U.S., like Yellowstone or Yosemite. But it's far harder when people want to come inside the park to kill elephants for ivory or wildebeest for food or to get that retreating lion who may have killed one of their cows. So the money is huge, and the current method for funding these areas is only providing a few percentage of what's needed. And so one of our big challenges going forward is trying to get the world to realize the expense and the shared burden that we all probably need to contribute to help cover the costs. Because otherwise, it's some of the poorest people in the world who have to endure the risks of a lion attack or a loss of their livestock or even their crops then to elephants.
Absolutely. And of course, there's a lot of mythology. Westerners, Europeans, Americans think of Africa and the African plains as the great wilderness. And yet, as you said, they are encroached upon by subdivision of land and agriculture and fences. I know your proposal of fencing off areas meets some controversy. There's debates back and forth. Do you believe countries such as Kenya, with Kenya Wildlife Service, are they considering fencing Tsavo or are they going to fence Tsavo?
So there's one boundary along the park that's already been fenced. There are other areas that are being contemplated. And, you know, really the thing about a fence is it doesn't have to be just along the park boundary, but it should be around the perimeter of the wildlife area, which may be outside the national park. So I've heard KWS making discussions about putting a fence, not around the Masai Mara, which is their famous park next to Serengeti, but some distance away, so that inside that area you have a dispersal zone where if there are livestock in there on a permit, and so it's understood that if they lose their livestock, that's their problem. But outside that, on the city side, as it were, then the protection of their livestock would be foremost. And so these are ideas that people are going to have to face because the human population is growing so rapidly. Most of the human population growth that we're expecting on the entire planet will be restricted pretty much to Africa. Mm. And once Africa is as crowded as India, you cannot have these vast wilderness areas.
But I know it gets political, it gets controversial. My understanding from your most recent book, which is excellent, is some of that controversy arose around your work with Serengeti Lion Project and even perhaps your publishing the question of the cost per square kilometers, you said, are African countries meeting those needs? Maybe tell a bit about that adventure.
Sure. So I wanted to know what worked to conserve lions. And so I requested information from all the different people that have been studying lions around Africa and asked them, how many lions do you have? I asked them, what's your management budget? Because obviously, if you have what's called a paper park, where the boundaries only exist on a map, but not actually on the ground, and people go back and forth with impunity, that's not going to protect anything. So it takes some amount of money to be able to protect any area. So once I had how the lion populations were faring, and I asked what the management budget was for the protected area that they were working, I then worked with a team from Oxford And we were able to estimate, well, how many lions should there be? Given the amount of prey that's there, or how rich the soils are, and how much rainfall it gets, you're going to expect a higher biomass of food for the lions, and therefore more lions. So when we put together those three components, how many lions are there, how many should there be, and how much is costing, then we could say, well, this is the bang for buck. And the paper parks, we had data from several of them, and these are some parks in Western Africa where the annual budget was something like $15 to $20 per square kilometer, which is nothing. And there are other areas where the management budget was nearly $10,000 per square kilometer. And not surprising, in the places that spend $10,000 per square kilometer, they're pretty close to having as many lions as they should based on the rainfall of the prey population. And those paper parks, no surprise, had very little. And so where that line crosses, where you have about 50% as many lions as you ought to based on the ecology of the area, that crosses at about $2,000 per square kilometer per year if the park isn't fenced. But if it was fenced, we had the same data from there, and there were some parks that even though they had to maintain their fence and everything inside it, they were getting by on a budget of maybe $200 per square kilometer, and they were doing fine. And so the fenced ones, for a given budget, give you a much greater bang for buck. And so therefore, we said, hey, you know, it's not only work, but in the long run, it would be cheaper if you maintain fences around these areas. Now, where the controversy arose was by people who are terrified of seeing Africa converted from their romantic vision of virgin wilderness to the 21st century, where you do have things that are highly managed. And some countries like South Africa are very proactive in the management. They look after everything very, very well. And hey, their wildlife does really well. But in East Africa, there's the view that, oh, everything is great. We're still in this virgin wilderness of the 19th century. But it's simply not true. And more data are coming out all the time showing that these populations, not just of lions, but giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
Giraffe decline precipitously. Almost every population of animals declining. And one of the things you can do is to put up a fence. But it depends. And we did put in this caveat in our original paper that where you have a migratory ecosystem, and these are drier areas where the boundary is right next to pasture land because it's too dry to grow crops. In those areas, you have the wildlife mingling with livestock. And so if you were to put a boundary across there, you would deny your wildebeest access to pasture lands at certain times of year. It would be catastrophic. But there are, I think, people who are worried that once you build one fence in a responsible way, there may be pressure from the local people to build fences everywhere. And I have to say, my bias is that, well, the local people are the ones that have to live with the lions. And my research team has worked in areas where there's been a lot of man-eating lions. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I'm going to take the side of the local people over the lions. If you can't put a fence around it, you can try to mitigate these risks to people and their livestock. And yes, do that. But where you can fence it, you should, because there's only so much money that's available to protect the species over its huge range. You've got to be wise in how you expend these limited resources. So fence where you can, but where you can't fence, you have to do these conflict mitigation projects. And frankly, it remains to be seen if these conflict mitigation projects will work in the very long term.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, tell us where you think we might be able to see wild lions, say, 50 years from now. You mentioned Kruger National Park. Do you think any of the other parks will be big enough?
Well, based on the trends, I'm reasonably comfortable that there'll be lions in any of the South African parks. In Botswana, there's a lot of lions up around the Okavango swamps. And provided that the water continues to flow as it has done historically, I think that area is reasonably safe because Botswana is a desert country, so you don't have this vast human population growth right on the edges of the reserve. Namibia, likewise, another desert country. We don't have vast human population growth. But in East Africa, I think it's going to depend on where people are able to effectively separate people from the wildlife, and where they're able to invest properly by putting enough money into these areas to pay the necessary management costs to protect people and wildlife. And so there may be one or two areas that are like that, but there may be others that we lose.
Well, this is fascinating work that you do and have for a long, long time, and look forward to seeing you here in Cincinnati this spring.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, and I'll see you soon. My guest has been Dr. Craig Packer, world-leading expert on the African lion.
Dr. Craig Packer, he'll be giving a presentation at the Cincinnati Zoo May 3rd about conserving lions on a crowded planet. We'll hear from the final scheduled speaker in the 2017 Barrows Conservation Lecture Series after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today's show was recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. We wrap up our preview of this year's Cincinnati Zoo Barrows Conservation Lecture Series with an interview Thane Maynard did with conservationist, photographer, and writer Joel Sartori.
Joel Sartori, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here, Thane.
I know the last time we were together, it was via Skype, but it's fun because you're going to be here this spring to give your talk, and I look forward to that.
That's right, in late May. I'm going to come out in conjunction with your exhibit you're doing on the photo arc.
Well, I'll tell you what, your work with that is so great, and I'm, of course, familiar with it because you've come to our zoo a number of times to photograph endangered species. But to be able to be one of three zoos in the nation that's partnering with you and with National Geographic to do the photo arc exhibit really is fun for us. So tell a bit about both that exhibit, but specifically about your important work on your photo arc project.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, this exhibit grows from the photos I've been doing now for 11 years. The photo arc is an attempt to document using studio lighting and black and white backgrounds every species in human care around the world. And we think that's between 12 and 13,000. And so far, after more than a decade, we've got about 6,500 species photographed that way. And the reason we use these black and white backgrounds is we want to give all creatures an equal voice. So, you know, they're all the same size. There's no size reference. A mouse is every bit as large and as intelligent and worthy of preserving as an elephant in these portraits. So that's why we do it this way. And yeah, I've been to Cincinnati Zoo several times, and it's always worked out really well. We've gotten a lot of good species from the zoo, and it's a world-class institution. So I'm really happy to be affiliated with you guys and to come out and speak here in late May.
Well, you know, that part will be fun for us. I've been fortunate to hear you speak a number of times, and you really bring a great story, certainly about this project, but also about your life as a National Geographic photographer and the connections to everything you've done and even your family. In this case, this idea of taking these pictures of species in captivity, many of which, I guess a growing number of which, are endangered, it's a very poignant thing, Joel. I know. Tell a bit about how you got that idea.
Well, I was a traveling, globe-trotting National Geographic photographer for a long time. I'm still with them, but about 12 years ago, my wife came down with breast cancer, and she's fine today, but we had three young kids at home, and she was really sick being treated for a year. And so I had a year to sit and think, finally, and I thought, well, what can I do with the rest of my life? My life's about half over. My career's certainly half over. What can I do to try to get the public to care about the extinction crisis and the fact that as these other species go away, so could we. And so I came up with this idea of, that other photographers have done before. I'm not the first, I'm not the last, but it's just the idea of isolating animals on black and white backgrounds and getting lighting on them so you can really see the true colors and really see what they look like. To show the world what biodiversity is, it's an amazing array of plants and animals we live here, we share a planet with, and I just want people to see what we could possibly be throwing away if we don't start paying a little bit more attention and setting aside habitats and leaving some wilderness spaces alone. And so the world has millions of species, but the world's zoos and aquariums and private breeders. They all have animals that are really amazing and hand-picked over the last century or two to represent the best of their classes. And so that's kind of what I set out to do. I just started out taking pictures, and it's grown and grown and grown into something that people can see around the world now.
And as you've said, I think it's a bit reminiscent of a century or more ago when people like Curtis and others said, let's document what's changing in that case in the American West.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And in fact, John James Audubon dedicated his life to painting birds and mammals that he thought might disappear. He could see that some were in trouble when he was painting them. And he gives us our only good, really good descriptions of the behaviors of several birds that are now gone.
Mm-hmm.
Two of which vanished. The last of their kinds were at Cincinnati Zoo, the Carolina parakeet and the passenger pigeon.
It's a thing we're infamous for, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. Well, by the time you guys got him, it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, and with Curtis as well, he could see that Native Americans were really going to have their ways of life upended by European settlers. So he dedicated his life to documenting their customs, their ways of dress, dance, housing, you name it. And so I thought the same should be done for the species of the world, because many of them, saying, live in muddy water or in the ground, under leaf litter, up high in the trees. Many animals are just never seen hardly at all, even by the biologists that study them. It's hard to see them. And so we've got a story on small cats right now that's out in the magazine, that most of these cats, people really don't have much knowledge of what they do in the wild. So yeah, I just thought it was important that if indeed we're on track to discard 50% of Earth species by 2100, it'd be nice to meet them. It'd be nice to see what they actually looked like, because by the time that they're reduced to just study skins in museum drawers, they don't have their color. You just can't tell what they were about, what they looked like. So, and really the goal of the ARC isn't to be a big obituary. It's to really get people to come alive to the fact that these animals are glorious and graceful and brilliant at living in their particular ecological niches and very worthy of preservation. And so that's kind of what the ARC's all about, get people to care and to save species now while there's still time.
Well, and the reason we're excited about your exhibit coming to the zoo this year is, since your program is largely zoo-based, it's a neat partnership between your work, the National Geographic Society, of course, which is one of the most respected organizations in the world, and zoos, because the neat thing about zoos is they reach everybody. You know, everybody that goes to Kroger, everybody that goes to Walmart, I mean, they go to zoos, right? So it's different than a fine art museum.
Right.
So how do we reach people with this message? The challenge is, while people, I think, understand a bit more about conservation and they maybe appreciate it more, the idea of how do we make an impact, that's the challenge.
Right, that's right. And people really need to realize, and I don't think they do quite yet, but they will soon enough, is that zoos really have gone from being simple menageries or collections when they first came about, 100 years ago, to being conservations today, conservation centers, I should say. I mean, many of the species I photograph would be extinct by now if it weren't for zoos doing captive breeding efforts in-house and in keeping the species going. Zoos also help with in-situ work, restoring habitat, anti-poaching patrols, education of local people, wherever those species exist. That's really important. And if zoos didn't do it, who would? It's the other thing about zoos is that they are really critical education centers. Zoos entertain millions of people a year around the world. And it's important to remember that if we don't keep each generation connected to the natural world, and zoos are a big part of that, they're not going to care. They're just not going to care as we go into the last wildernesses and exploit them for trees and mining, overfishing. We have to have connections to the natural world. For people that live in urban areas, zoos are it. And so I'm a big fan of zoos and aquariums that are run well, and Cincinnati sure is, and I'm excited to come out.
Well, it'll be fun. Now, tell us a bit about, over your career, how getting the message out has changed, because I'm old enough that I remember waiting at home for the magazine with the yellow border, and there it is.
Right.
And yet today, my sense is more people see Joel Sartori photographs on their telephone than have ever seen them in print in a magazine.
Yeah, that's right. It used to be if we had an environmental issue we wanted to address and tell people about, it would take a year or more to get it into the magazine. And a lot of people would see it. And a lot of people still do see the magazine. But what's amazing about the power of social media now is the Geographic Instagram reaches well over 70 million people each day.
Unbelievable.
And so, yeah, if we have... It used to be when I would ask to go to a zoo and get access to photograph their animals, I would say, hey, we can give you free pictures. And now we can say, hey, you not only get pictures to use as you need to promote the zoo, but we can basically introduce your zoo and your animals to an entirely new audience, a broad audience, a global audience. And that's a powerful thing and something we don't take for granted. It's very satisfying to see if someone has need or an animal has need, we can get the word out. And people do care. People care and they want to help. They just need to know what to do. That's really an amazing development that's happened in the last few years.
Now, give us some insight into your particular, whether it's Instagram or Facebook or however you get your pictures out, because I have to assume you get feedback, right? So maybe you've got a cute baby animal or is there any feedback you get?
Well, people love baby animals. They absolutely do. And they love stories of hope. They love seeing animals that are making a comeback. They love seeing animals that have been saved from the brink of extinction. They really enjoy seeing the work that's being done, not only at zoos, but at wildlife rehab centers as well. That's a favorite of people. The things that, you know, we've heard a lot of things over the years about bad zoos and bad aquariums. And that's a place that we don't go very much for the photo arc. And it's something that's not happening near as much as people think. The places I go are AZA accredited, Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and the animals get abundant attention and care. It's really super critical that for many of the species that I photograph, that they thrive, that they continue to thrive in captivity until people get smart enough to save habitat for them in the wild. So in terms of the comments, mostly positive. Once in a while we see negative, but we shrug that off and keep going as best we can. I mean, no matter what the political situation is in this country, we keep doing the work. We're going to keep going until we're done. And we just want to show people how amazing biodiversity is and why they should care.
And I assume when you get the negatives, it's probably if you have a picture of a bug or some creature, they're like, bring back the pretty animals.
Yeah, people really like animals that look like us.
There you go.
Primates with big eyes, baby mammals. They like birds second, and least are cockroaches and spiders. Sure. And we get a lot of negative comments on those, but we photograph the cockroaches and the spiders. Nonetheless, they're all equal to us. We just want to make sure that they get an equal voice and an equal representation too, so we don't discriminate. We photograph everything that we can.
Well, of course, the humor on that you and I know is there are far more species of spiders in the world than there are all vertebrates put together. So there are going to be a few pictures somewhere, right?
There have to be, don't there?
That's right.
And, I mean, I'm not a huge... People say, well, what's your least favorite? I'm not a huge fan of cockroaches, and I've probably photographed 20 different species so far. But I don't know why that is. I just don't care for them very much. But I never turn them down. I photograph everything equally.
That's right.
And people say, what's your favorite? And I just say, well, the next one. I'm always excited about getting a new species in. And the cockroach counts as much as anything else. So we keep going. And people don't realize also that really the least among us, these small species, they're the ones that really run the world, like we have some beetles.
Exactly.
And so that's what we focus on.
Well, Joel, we're excited that you're coming to town in May and that we'll have your exhibit starting May and then through the summer. So it'll be a great year to partner with you. So thanks for doing this interview, and I'll see you soon.
You bet. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Dan.
All right. Thanks. My guest has been Joel Sartori, the photographer of the Photo Arc.
Joel Sartori. He'll be the final speaker at this year's Cincinnati Zoo Barrows Conservation Lecture Series on May 31st. The series starts March 1st. You can find more information by visiting our website, wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai, and Josh Ostro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.